Well, this morning, I think what we really want to discuss is some of the pioneering work that you did, Maestro Stokowski, in connection with stereophonic sound. And of course, as we all know, stereophonic sound is reproduction in auditory perspective. That is, the spatial relations of the original sound sources are transferred in reproduction. And of course, obviously, it's a big step in the direction of providing the listener with sound reproduction, which is a close resemblance of the original. And I know, Maestro Stokowski, that you have carried on this work with the scientists, and you have been a pioneer in a pursuit of improved sound reproduction. And in almost every new development in sound reproduction, you have given the scientists encouragement and backing. And I think today we'd like to just reminisce a little bit about some of the work, the early work that you did in this field of stereophonic sound reproduction.
It seems to me that there are two forms of this. One is listening to music in the home, the other in the cinema house. And they are quite different and should be treated differently. And in listening to music in the home, which I do almost every night of my life, when I don't have a concert or a rehearsal somewhere, the thing I notice is that in my living room, which is an average size, about the same size that most people have, conditions are totally different from in the concert hall. And some of my friends say to me, I want to listen to music as I hear it in the concert hall or in the opera house. Then the next question is, which opera house and which concert hall? Because they're all different. I've conducted in practically all the concert halls of the world, and they all give a totally different impression. But if one were to say, for example, as some of my friends do, well, I live in New York City, I'm accustomed to hearing music in Carnegie Hall, I'd like to hear it in my room as it is in Carnegie Hall. Then comes this question, which part of Carnegie Hall are you sitting in? Because if you sit in certain boxes or down in the parquet, I think they call it, downstairs, or where I always go in Carnegie Hall, that's in the top gallery, again, against the back wall up there, where, in my opinion, the music sounds best blended, the impression of the music is different in those places. So the whole question of listening to music in the home as you want to do, as you do in a concert hall, is a misnomer. It's not possible. The air containing of Carnegie Hall is enormous, and the sound waves develop in that space. In the average living room, it's perhaps 3% of that only. Anyway, it's much less. So conditions are so different that I think we should be, if possible, a little sensible and say, I'd like to hear the music of great composers of all periods and all countries in my home, in my living room. I'd like to hear the spirit of that music, the message that that music conveys, and not try to hear it as it is in a concert hall, which is, frankly, impossible.
Well, I think that's right, Maestro Stokowski, but don't you think that if we start looking at the subjective aspects of sound reproduction, that perhaps we can attain a closer resemblance to the live rendition? It's true that now we have perfected the system from a physical standpoint, so the characteristics are indeed quite good. But we've paid very little attention to the subjective aspects of sound reproduction. And after all, sound reproduction is really subjective when you come right down to it.
You are using a very important word, subjective. Would you, and I agree with you, but could you explain to me what is your impression of subjective listening to music?
Well, the subjective listening to music, from my standpoint, is this, as contrasted to the objective. The objective we can measure with meters and so on. The subjective is the artistic impact that the music has upon me. That is the way I feel about the subjective. It is not the actual sound pressure developed at the ear, but it's the impact that has from an artistic standpoint.
I entirely agree with you. That is practically the only way we can receive the inspiration and the beauty that music can bring into our lives. So if we speak of the objective side, that is the scientific side, I think we have to remember that of all scientific knowledge of sound, we know a small amount. What we do not know is enormous, enormous. So I think we should not be too confident about the little we do know, and remember the immense amount we do not yet know, and which we hope in time to know through further experimentation. And we should concentrate on the subjective, as you so rightly said.
Well, carrying on from the point that you mentioned at Carnegie Hall in the living room, we've carried on some tests in this respect. And I think it's interesting to note that the average listener in the home listens at a peak level of about 80 decibels, whereas in Carnegie Hall it's 100 decibels.
More.
And more. But the reflections do not occur as rapidly in Carnegie Hall, as you mentioned, because it's a large room, and the reflections do not come at you as fast as they do in a small room. Therefore, the average person cannot tolerate this high level in a small room because he feels it's harsh. So there, right away, we have a situation in which the ear is involved, the difference in the performance of the ear at the high level and at the lower level in the living room. So this is another subjective, a very simple subjective aspect of a sound. I mean, one of the factors that are involved.
Yes, I entirely agree with you. Here you have mentioned a very great difference. The dynamic range in the average living room compared with the dynamic range in a hall like Carnegie Hall is enormously different, and we must always keep that in mind. I think that I find personally in listening to music in my living room, when the music makes what we call a crescendo up to fortissimo, I can set that level, and then when the music makes diminuendo down to pianissimo, as we call it, that takes care of itself usually. And I imagine that's what everybody has to do, because if we were trying to make a dynamic range like in Carnegie Hall, it would be really painful to the ears.
Well, I would like to just discuss a little bit with you, Maestro Stokowski, some of the work that you did in Fantasia, because I think there, even today, that is considered to be an experiment in stereophonic sound, and it was culminated, of course, in an actual commercial venture in which you used a large number of tracks so you could then change the auditory perspective in reproduction. You could also put sound in motion, which we're just beginning to use now in stereophonic sound, but also recording on a large number of tracks so you could change the auditory perspective of the orchestra. I would like to ask you really what you had in mind here from a musical standpoint in using so many tracks and also changing the auditory perspective and also producing sound in motion.
We had in mind, or Disney had in mind, that what is seen on the screen in Fantasia sometimes had motion, and that motion could be reproduced also for the listener sitting in the theater. And we found a way to do it using experiments that a few years before that had been made by Bell Laboratory in New York, when they made a projection of sound in motion from New York to Washington, so that persons in a theater in Washington could see, for example, someone walk across the stage. The sounds of his footsteps might work from the right across the stage to the left. One could see that and at the same time hear it. The same could be done, of course, with sound and with music. And that was Disney's idea, and I thought it was a wonderful, broad-minded, progressive way of thinking on his part. So we worked at that together and finally were able to a very great extent succeed. Unfortunately, now when Fantasia is seen and heard today, this perspective is much less than it was at that time, because Disney was then willing to go to the utmost limit to succeed in that great thought. But I'm sure that in future this idea will be carried still farther. Then there is another question that I think we should keep in mind. We are all, or most of us, those music lovers, we are accustomed to hear music from a stage to the seat wherever we may be sitting. And that is directional. It is possible to listen to music non-directionally, and we did this a long time ago in Holland, in Amsterdam, when I was conducting that wonderful orchestra, the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. A certain company, what is the name of that company? They make electric light bulbs.
Philips.
That's there. Thank you. That's the name. Philips said to me, "Would you be willing that we take all your rehearsals and all your concerts, record them on 4 channels, and would you be willing then to listen from 4 channels?" Of course, I was most interested, and we did that. Then the result was we listened in a fairly large average living room, sitting in the middle of the room with speakers in the 4 corners, and we heard the music so that the speakers were so balanced that it was non-directional, but it was a very full, very eloquent expression of the music. And to my mind, that is a future possibility. And of course, it will be difficult to do it because some people, I almost said many people, do not like any kind of a new idea. They resist everything that's new, some people do. But there are other persons who delight in new possibilities, in experimentation. And I think for those persons, they would find non-directional listening extremely interesting and eloquent.
Well, I think that's certainly true. In this connection with, if we go back to some of the early days, for example, in 1936, RCA installed a stereophonic sound reinforcing system in the Radio City Music Hall. Of course, it always has had a sound reinforcing system, but it's stereophonic, and it's been stereophonic since that time, since 1936. And, of course, this makes it possible to have a symphony orchestra in a very large hall and still maintain the auditory perspective. And without the sound reinforcing system, of course, in the Radio City Music Hall, it would be impossible to operate, particularly for the people on the stage. And as a matter of fact, even the large orchestra there sounds very weak without the reinforcing system, and it's quite realistic. And I was wondering whether you think that we shouldn't build perhaps larger halls with sound reinforcing systems, stereophonic, or whether we should stick to the smaller halls without any reinforcing systems.
I think the answer to that is twofold. Number one, the ear can take in sounds up to a certain dynamic range and range of frequencies. But the eye works differently. I notice when I go to music hall here in New York and I sit back far as possible from the stage, the persons on the stage look about 3 inches high. And I think that it's the eye that's going to set our limit rather than the ear. Because, as you rightly say, we can enlarge the sound electrically and do it well. But the eye, we cannot enlarge unless we use some kind of glasses to enlarge the vision. And I think people will not wish to do that. I know I wouldn't myself. If I go to the theater to hear a play of Shakespeare or any great play, I like to see it in a natural, simple way, and I would like to see the actors and actresses so intimately that I can even see the expression of their eyes and their face. Therefore, the theater should not be, in my opinion, too large anyway for drama. But for concerts, I think there's practically no limit. It just is a question, how expert is the enlargement of the sound? How little does it distort? How does it give the true perspective and the true dynamic range of the music? Always remembering that what we must do, our privilege and our duty is to convey from the composer to the listener truly the message of the music. And that is something very difficult. Taking, for example, we'll say a Beethoven symphony. We see on the score Beethoven's ideas. That score is really like a blueprint. What a blueprint is to an architect, that is what a score is to the composer. Now, the ideas of that blueprint, to convey those fully to the listener, has to be done through an orchestra of roughly 100 players. All those players are different. Particularly in America, all the players in our orchestra, they come from, many are American-born, but some are from Russia, from Poland, from Italy, from all kinds of countries. And they all have different characteristics, musical characteristics, and mental characteristics, so that the modern orchestra becomes extremely complex. And how to overcome all those complexities and give a unified impression of what Beethoven was thinking when he wrote down that blueprint or score, how to convey that eloquently and truly without distortion to the listeners is very, very difficult.
Well, I want to recall another interesting experiment that you carried out. I remember you visited us in the RCA Laboratories in Princeton, and you saw an electronic contrabass that we had developed down there. And I think your feeling has been that the low frequencies in a hall, particularly in the case of a symphony, are not in balance with the higher frequencies. That is, there's some deficiency in the low frequencies, and you saw this electronic contrabass, and in your Easter concert in Carnegie Hall, I remember you employed that to reinforce the low frequencies, and I was just wondering how you felt about that since that time, that is, about this whole business of the balance of an orchestra, because this is coming to be more and more important, and we read so much about that, the fact that there's a deficiency in the low frequency and of a symphony orchestra in the average hall?
It's not a question of opinion, it's just a fact. One can easily measure the sound of a good player playing a good contrabass. And instruments will show, as well as our ear will tell us, that the low frequencies are weak in relation to the upper partials or the overtones or harmonics or whatever one likes to call them. They are very rich for the contrabass, and the low tones, or the fundamental tone as we call it, is very weak. The result is that when one listens to a first-class orchestra, and we have several very great orchestras in this country, and of course there are others in Europe too, and also in Japan. When we listen to a really first-class orchestra, it truly is out of balance. The low frequencies are weak in relation to the middles, and particularly the very highs, like the tones which are produced by the piccolo, for example, in the high register of the piccolo, that they are extremely intense. So we have always been accustomed to listen to orchestra that way, and it's become a habit of the ear to accept it that way. But I do not accept it that way, and I would like to find a way to create a better balance between the extreme highs and the extreme lows. And the instrument you mentioned that RC had there, RCA, was a very important step in that direction. Another instrument that has been produced by the Allen Company in Pennsylvania, the Allen Organ Company, have produced a keyboard instrument which will enlarge and strengthen the deep sounds of the basses, of the contrabass in the orchestra, playing with them, perhaps not all the time, but in certain important moments. The way to really judge this, I think, a simple way is a good pipe organ in a church or cathedral with good pedals gives an impression of depth and power to those low frequencies, which we do not have in the orchestra. I'm not saying that I prefer the organ to the orchestra, because I do not. The organ is a very mechanical instrument, a wonderful instrument, but it is mechanical, whereas the orchestra is human. Human feeling is back of every player there, and the human heart. But we could learn from the pedal sounds of a great organ what is that glorious foundation to the whole tonal structure that the pedals give, which is lacking in the orchestra. We're accustomed to accepting it in the orchestra, but I would like to see more done to overcome this lack of balance. And the instrument that you mentioned in RCA did do that, and the instrument that this Allen Organ Company has developed also does it. I'm not a member of the Allen Organ Company. I'm not advertising them. I'm just thankful to them that they have done this, which makes it possible.
Well, there is indeed a lot of work going on, and I think that the pioneering work that you've done in this whole field is certainly manifested today and has been manifested for a number of years. For example, in 1948, RCA introduced stereophonic pre-recorded magnetic tape, and this enjoyed a very great success for about a decade, and practically all of the record companies were producing stereophonic magnetic tapes. And of course, that being the case, it's only natural that the stereophonic discs should come into the picture, and it did indeed come into the picture in 1958, stereophonic disc reproduction. And of course, the introduction of a stereophonic disc provided the great impetus to widespread use of stereophonic sound reproduction in the home. As a matter of fact, in this country today, I think that more than half of the records that are sold, particularly in the classical field, are stereophonic records. And I think this is really a great tribute to you, Maestro, your early experiments and showing the way in stereophonic reproduction of sound. And I think the disc now has made it possible to bring this auditory perspective into the home. True, as we discussed a little bit earlier, there are deficiencies, but it does indeed make the reproduction of music certainly a big step in the direction of being more realistic.
Yes, Dr. Olson, I entirely agree with you, but there's another thing which I think should be done, and that is we have in the world concert halls such as, for example, in Vienna, are two concert halls which, in my opinion, are very great, which are as ideal as is humanly possible. That's one is the Große Musikvereinsaal, and the other is the Konzerthaus. Now, in those halls, the balance between highs and lows is extremely good. But there are other halls in other parts of the world where it is not good. And one reason, I think, is that architects do not consider or study the question of sound. They seem to be, I have the impression, perhaps I'm wrong, but they are thinking of the visual part, to make a beautiful hall for the eye. Whereas I think that if a concert hall is going to be planned and conceived, the first consideration, absolutely the first consideration, must be sound, because that's why you build a concert hall, that people may listen to music. And the architects, I hope they will forgive me, but the fact is they do not know. And we have seen in various parts of the world the failure and of the acoustics of these concert halls, and the person being blamed has been the acoustical engineer, and he was not the culprit. The culprit, or the person who made these bad conditions, was the architect, because he would not consult with persons who know about these things. And the first consideration should be sound. And I could tell you where, for example, I learned very much from talking to the players in the orchestra. In every orchestra, there are about 100 players. There are 7, 8, 9, or 10 extremely sensitive, intelligent players. Every day of their life, they are making music and listening to the relation of what they play to the other instruments and how it sounds in the hall. These people have not scientific knowledge, but they do have experimental knowledge, an enormous experimental knowledge gained through a whole lifetime of listening. And that experimental knowledge should be used, and I find it is not used. And it would be so simple to talk to those players. They would be very happy to give their impressions, I'm quite sure of it. Unfortunately, the architect does not do that. Result is waste of time, an immense waste of money too. And in the meantime, people are listening to music created by great composers like Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Brahms, Debussy, etc. They are listening to that music distorted, not by the players of the orchestra, but by the architect, by what he has failed to do in the concert hall. I hope it's safe for me to go out in the street now and there are no architects outside of this place.
Well, I think that it's certainly a sad situation that we cannot copy these halls in Vienna, for example, which are indeed outstanding. And they were probably developed by purely empirical means and were maximized. And it seems to me that it would be possible to copy the interior of the halls, the acoustics, and all these other factors, and still perhaps get some of the artistic embellishments like that the architect likes.
Dr. Olson, you're absolutely right. They were empirical. But I'll tell you places which are not empirical. The hall in Boston, right close here in Boston, has a very fine acoustic and was planned by a technician who understood, by a scientific person. For the moment, I forget his name. But that was scientific.
Sabine, I think.
Sabine, that's right, Sabine, yes. That was scientifically planned and has proved to be one of the greatest halls in the world. So it can be done.
Oh, it indeed can be done. And, of course, some people may say that's a very uninteresting hall to the eye. But it seems to me that if they wanted to, put in some of the things that the orchestra, that the architect thinks would be interesting, why, it certainly could be done. Well, I think that in the years since your early experiments, why, stereophonic sound has come a long way. We now have FM radio, which was introduced in 1961, and I now have it in my automobile with a multiplex, and I can get stereophonic sound reproduction in my car while I'm driving.
Dr. Olson, you should be arrested for having that thing in your car, because to drive a car requires utmost concentration, not on what you're doing, but what the other people are doing. And you are doing two things. You're trying to do two things. Listen to your stereophonic sounds there and drive a car, and also three things, and watch what the other people are doing, should not be doing. So I will arrange for you to be arrested. All right?
All right. I think we should end that on that.
I understand the cuisine in some of our American prisons is very good.
Okay. Well, that's wonderful. Well, this has been a very, very enjoyable discussion with you, Maestro. I've enjoyed it very much, and hope to see you again very soon.
I'll bring flowers to the prison for you.
Thank you.